to State versus Dangsel. I'm going to ask for appearances from where people are. Say it nice and loud, if that's all right, so that we can go through the list and hopefully be able to hear it, starting with Mr. Neary.
Chief Justices, Justices of the Court, my name is Brian Neary. I represent the defendant appellant, Wildemir Dangsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Joe Kukora, public defender for the state of New Jersey, on behalf of Amicus Public Defender's Office and the ACLU of New Jersey. Thank you, Chief.
Good morning, Lawrence S. Lusberg, Gibbons PC, on behalf of Amicus New Jersey State Bar Association.
Good morning, Your Honor. Marissa Koblitz-Kingman from Fox Rothschild on behalf of the ACDL of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jamie M. Chasmer, Assistant Prosecutor for the state of New Jersey.
Good morning. Deputy Attorney General Lila B. Leonard for the Attorney General.
Special Deputy Attorney General, Acting Camden County Assistant Prosecutor, appearing as a friend of the court on behalf of the County Prosecutors Association of New Jersey.
Welcome to all counsel. We're pleased to have you today. As you know, the court granted the defendant's motion in this case for direct certification limited to the following: defendant's challenge to the hybrid virtual in-person jury selection procedure. That's the only issue that is in front of the court for argument today. I know that amici have added some issues. We have your briefs with respect to potential question about a conflict, with respect to representation of the AOC, collection of demographic data, and certain other matters. We have your submissions on that. We will consider them. We do not need argument on those, and I ask you to rest on your papers with respect to that. And I'm asking everyone, and I realize this will trim the argument for certain of the advocates who are here today, to focus solely on the legal question of the hybrid virtual in-person jury selection process in this case. I'd also ask amici, in view of the number of fine advocates that we have here today, to be prepared to limit their arguments to 5 to 10 minutes. We will start with Mr. Neary. Please step forward.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Chief Justice, two questions. The protocol with regard to masks.
You may remove it.
Thank you. The second is, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Chief. I represent Wildemir Dangsel. He was the first defendant charged and tried in one of the most dramatic jury cases in the jurisprudence of this state. His trial was a hybrid jury trial with the selection process done through the miracles of Zoom. This argument is not about whether technology works. We all agree that technology works in this system. Technology has been a great aid to allow the court systems and this state to continue its pursuit of justice on behalf of all. It is not an argument with regard to whether or not the efficacy of questioning via Zoom is appropriate. That's not the issue. The issue presented today is the issue as to whether or not that in the compiling and bringing together a veneerman with regard to this, were there certain constitutional violations? Was the right to presence of the defendant not abided by? Was the right to have counsel participate not abided by? And the third is whether or not we can tell whether or not there's a fair cross-section of the community that was invited to participate. The procedural history has to be woven along with not only Mr. Dangsel's case, but the efforts by the court and by the administrative office of the court to get this procedure together. It was the product of working groups, it was the product of orders, it was product of plans. And I think the examination of each and every one of those will lead us to the position of how this was done and what may have been flawed. Remember, this was the first time that these were ever done. This was the maiden voyage of a dangerous, well, let me not say dangerous, let me just say an adventure that we all invite to accomplish. I think we got to focus on the plan. I think we have to focus for a moment, at least, on the orders. There was a pre-screening plan that was devised by the by order, as well as by a plan that was promulgated prominently. We all have seen it. It's a part of my appendix with regard to how this was done. And I focus on the so-called pre-screening. Now, it's important to note that numbers matter. Dank Cell is number one with regard to it. Dank Cell faced five serious counts, including attempted murder. But the real numbers came with regard to the to an order to show cause that was filed, a selection of jurors, and finally an argument before the trial counsel with regard to the order to show cause, where for the first time, really, numbers about what happened were revealed. First in a certification by Brian McLaughlin, who's the statewide jury manager, also by Lourdes Figueroa, who is the Bergen County manager. And I only suggest this because I think it's important to look at these and to juxtapose with regard to the statute as well as the court rule with how we pre-screen jurors. Now, it was Brother McLaughlin suggested in his certification that this was always the way that we did it. I respectfully disagree. This is the first time we ever had the concern, a universal concern, of the pandemic. Universal, that all that we had focused on in terms of this case, in terms of that jury selection, ran through the prism of COVID-19, the pandemic, and this court's effort to ensure both public safety as well as the administration of justice. No other time had a questionnaire ever been given to a juror, sent to prospective jurors, on a singular issue, their reaction and with regard to COVID-19. So as Mr. McLaughlin suggested that, I would respectfully suggest it was different. Now, it's important, I think, again, with numbers, because 800 jurors were summoned, 533 were actually completed questionnaires. So that we also have to, and there were three categories of people before they actually went on a Zoom platform. Now, I'm going to make this point. Pre-COVID, we could put 150 jurors in a room and ask them a varying series of questions, including whether or not they had vacation plans, whether or not they felt that they could serve, whether or not they had economic difficulties. But remember the technical limitation of Zoom. You could only get 30 people in a room, 30 in the morning and 30 in the afternoon. We know that from the plan. So we go through that. And I think whether it's advertent or inadvertent, that as we talked about the three categories of qualifications, whether or not somebody was qualified, the five or six different things, the age, the residency, the speaking of English, those categories, those are easy. Those are easy. The excuses, which are more cataloged, which require more discretion. Just take a look at them. And very honestly, if you ask an experienced trial lawyer, that those questions are often asked by the trial judge when the veneer shows up, no matter how many people are in the room. It's not unusual that somebody says, I'm going on vacation next week, or I can't sit for 4 weeks. The response of the judge often could be, well, we have a shorter trial down the hallway. Can you sit for that jury trial? It was not just simply the fact that, oops, you're not going to be available in X number of weeks, you get to go. And then finally, the deferrals that was prior to COVID were self-executing. Think about that, self-executing. I can't be here this week, but I'll put it off for 3 weeks. I'll put it off for 3 months. It was self-executing. That was changed because now a direct question was now put through the case manager to that particular person. And that's the three areas where I believe, respectfully, that a trial court did not have the opportunity to manage that, to review that information, and more importantly, that counsel would not have the opportunity to watch, to listen, to see whether or not whether the excuses were appropriate, whether the
Neary,
yes, Justice.
I take your argument then. You're exclusively focusing on the constitutional right to be present and have representation. That's what all of these points are about,
right?
Correct.
What flows from that, Justice, I believe, is the third thing, whether or not we're able to determine whether or not there's a fair cross-section of the community. Now,
stay with the first.
Sure.
Justice is asking about. Your argument is that these components become a critical stage where a defendant has a constitutional right to be present, right?
Absolutely, Chief.
So explain why, if an individual, a prospective juror, has a doctor's note seeking an excuse, that is a critical stage as opposed to a ministerial act.
Well, the doctor's note would be unique to the particular individual. It's not what I would call emergent, not emergent. It's the kind of thing that borders, I think, on it's administrative. That's easy. But the problem here was that each of the prospective jurors had to run through my word of the prism through their reaction availability to the pandemic. That's what's different. If we didn't have a pandemic, we wouldn't even do this.
This is what I'm trying to understand. Forget about the COVID questions. What was different in the administrative selection, the initial pre-screening of the veneer? Okay, during the post-pandemic period compared to the pre-pandemic, just the pre-screening of the veneer. I'm not talking about the jury selection now, because it's those pre-screening questions that's winnowing down the numbers. You know, people who have medical conditions that prohibit them from sitting. So tell me what the differences were.
Well, I understand what the statute says, and I know, you know.
Can I interrupt you for a second? You seem to indicate that if there weren't for the pandemic, there would have voir dire, there would be no excuse available to the jurors about a doctor's note or going on vacation. Did I understand you say that didn't happen before the pandemic?
No, you did. Often that was done in person. That was done when the jurors came to the courtroom. So now, I understand the statute allows that.
Start with the pre-screening. Okay. That's when everyone's responding to the summons. So
right.
tell us how it was different. Other than the COVID questions, tell us how it was different.
The fact that while the statute provided that the manager could, it was permissive, not mandatory, exercise, that person was generally brought into court and brought among the full veneer. That's what the difference is that we invested more time and we invested more.
I don't know that you're understanding my question, or maybe you're not answering the question. Before the pandemic, administrators would make decisions that this person is like over the age, not qualified. Okay, that's not going to a judge. There may be other issues, pre-screening issues, where the person just cannot sit for whatever reason. Maybe the person can't understand English or whatever. So what I want you to do is tell me what was different with respect to the pre-screening process. If anything, you may say nothing.
No, deferrals. Deferrals. We'll start with deferrals. Deferrals otherwise were self-executing.
So that you should be saying wonderful. That, I thought, is what you want. But it's not self-executing. It's going before a judge.
But no, but the next, the problem here was of the, I believe it was 50, there were 58 deferrals that were given by case management. Remember, respectfully, that is a new procedure. They were being screened on the issue of COVID. Who was excused and who wasn't excused? Why they were excused or why weren't they excused?
Are you saying that prior to the pandemic, the COVID, the deferral was given by a judge that managers did not do?
No, every deferral.
That's not accurate at all.
No, every deferral was given automatically. You deferred to a different year. That was a self-executing through jury management.
Let me see if I understand. The self-deferral option was removed. So pre-COVID, none of those 58 jurors could possibly have sat on your client's case, correct? they would have deferred on their own and not been part of the larger veneer. Isn't that
correct? But the question was...
Stay with me for a second.
Sure.
Is that correct?
I'm hesitating, Chief. I'm hesitating because I don't think it is. I don't think it is. And I'll tell you why. It's because there's an investiture of authority with regard to the case manager. That's the difference.
I'm simply referring to the disabling of the self-deferral. Pre-COVID, individuals could have said, I'm putting it off, and they therefore would not have sat on the jury in your client's case. They no longer had that option. So pivoting off of Justice Albin's earlier question, isn't that a benefit to you? How is it a violation of your client's constitutional...
It becomes a benefit if we knew the standard by which the jury manager exercised that authority, one or the other. So what...
And you're going to the next step. The simple fact that self-deferrals were eliminated, how does that in and of itself violate your client's constitutional rights?
Because it invests in the jury manager a discretion that I now don't know about. Were all 58 people deferred automatically? We don't know that. We don't know how that number was determined. There may have been more people who asked for the self deferral.
You're telling us the self-deferral would have been better. We didn't even want these people being examined. Is that what you're saying?
No, the question is that they were examined, not that they weren't examined.
I understand, but if they weren't being examined for their suitability for service, they would have been deferred. Is that the alternative that you prefer, that they could have just self-deferred?
This is being argued in the context of how this jury was being constituted at this time and this era. This plan...
This is Justice Alvin's question. Would you prefer the self-deferral or not?
Post-COVID, yes. Post-COVID, or when we're all back and we're not using the system, yes. But in this particular circumstance, under this plan, under these and with the what I'll call the COVID questionnaire. Remember, that's the elephant in this room. That's what everything is being, not this room, the process that it's being run through. And what I'm suggesting is that it invests in the case manager, a discretion that for this set of circumstances is inappropriate. Chief, you then just said, I'm arguing the second thing. Absolutely, because I think, I'll use the term, bleeds over to. Now we now have an investiture again of this discretion. I understand what the statute said. I understand what the...
I want to understand where this is going. The veneer may be a group of people who may be serving on any number of juries, correct? The larger veneer.
Right, but remember...
Am I correct?
Right.
I want to understand what you're looking for. Are you saying that all of the potential attorneys in all of the potential cases where these people may serve on juries should be involved in determining whether or not some jury manager decides you're going on vacation, you can go or you can't go? That's where you want to be? You want to be making that decision?
And I say this respectfully. So we don't want to get a phone call every afternoon and say, we got a letter from somebody that they're going to Disney World next week or something, so that we have to chime in. That's not what the fear is. The fear is here in this circumstances. That's why I keep going back to this plan, going back to this order, going back to where we are here, is that we don't know what the exercise of that discretion was either on deferral. We don't know what the exercise of discretion was on excusal. On excusal also, because it's the excusal questions to be...
This is why you've argued it's a critical stage where you and your client have the right to be present.
Yes, yes.
So, because we're talking about a large pool that is being whittled down and that can then serve for multiple jury trials scheduled in the courthouse at the same time, is the logical extension of your argument that all of the defendants, all of the defense attorneys, and all of the prosecutors have the right to be present as the pre-screening takes place for all the trials that panel will then be used for?
See, the answer, if we have all the trials and all the answer is no. If it's all the trials. But the problem here is it's singular. It's one case. It's one test.
But we're still trying to come up with the larger veneer panel through some of these preliminary questions. Do you have a medical excuse? Do you have a vacation? All of these sorts of things that, to my understanding, had been routinely done before you ended up in the courtroom. If you're right that your client has the right to be present for that, don't you then have that same right when the process and the other courtrooms down the hall have the same right?
If I was saying this respectfully, post-COVID, when we're back, yes. But here, and I think we cannot miss this particular point of this argument, is that COVID is the predominant universal theme in the jury selection. Why else do we have, really for the first time, a questionnaire that is directed directly towards the disease and the pandemic? It's directed to there. Because
the questionnaire, Mr. Neary, was not prepared just for your client's case. It was prepared for use in all of the veneers that were going to be called in the various vicinages.
Right.
So how are we going to practically give you the kind of relief that you're asking for? Following up on the chief's question, would we have civil lawyers and criminal lawyers both chiming in on whether or not a particular deferral or excuse should be able to be granted in the pre-screening process? How do you reconcile those various views?
On Mosna, no, Justice, no. But what I'm saying is, and I've been here representing institutions and argued on behalf. My argument is singular to Mr. Dangsell. It's singular to this trial. You know, while I love my brothers and they have separate arguments, all I care about is Dangsell. And I'm saying in this process, done the first time, that we don't know, and more importantly, that counsel for Dangsell and Mr. Dangsell himself do not know the exercise of that challenge. It gets us to
there were no records kept by the jury managers as to why people were excused?
Doesn't seem that way, Justice. Doesn't seem that way. Later on, the trial judge gave the list of the answers to the COVID questions. The better thing would have been, who was excused and why were they excused?
Let's stay with the COVID questions. You got the answers for those, for the people who were excused?
Right.
Okay. So, look, have you tested positive for COVID-19 within the last 21 days? You got a problem with that?
No.
It wouldn't make a difference. If someone was asked, have you, in the last 21 days, been tested positive for the bubonic plague? You'd be okay to excuse that person?
Justice, we'll go down that whole list of questions. Anytime I go into a courthouse, they ask me that whole series of questions. But the focus there is on health concerns. Am I okay or am I going to bring the diseases? The issue we're worried about here is what is the effect of the disease on the greater population? My argument, and this goes to the fair cross-section, I think we have to recognize, I think we all recognize, that the general societal view is that COVID has effects on varying communities.
So are you making a distinction? Think of two scenarios. One is someone calls the jury manager and says, I'm going in for surgery, heart surgery, next week, and I won't be able to serve.
That's easy.
You don't contend that your client has any right to be present when that conversation plays itself out between the jury manager and that individual, and the jury manager presumably gives a deferral or an excuse.
Justice, I would almost think that is almost an emergent type kind of request. You know, the proverbial, I can't show up to jury because I'm in the hospital
tonight.
You're making an
argument that this is a critical stage at which you and your client have the right to be present. So I'm asking you whether if it doesn't involve COVID, but it's health and it's a health issue, your contention is that you have no, that's not a critical stage, and you have no right. Am I right about that?
Right.
It doesn't have to do with COVID. Okay.
How about a vacation note?
Vacation note.
Is that a critical stage where you have the right to be present?
Well, I've seen, Chief, I've seen it both ways.
I'm just asking the legal question.
As a critical stage, my answer is it could be. Forgive a very lawyer-like answer, but it could be. It could be because, and I've seen trial judges say, well, this case is only going to take 2 weeks, so you're going to go away for 4 weeks.
That's different. We're talking at the pre-screening stage. Okay, for the veneer. Forget about the jury selection. Of course, when the jury is being selected, you're participating in that. You want to, when the larger veneer is being decided, you want to be in there to determine whether or not the person gets that two-week vacation? Is that?
I'm worried about now what the reaction of the potential veneer person would be with regard to the predicament we're in right now in terms of COVID. As I suggested, the wider society recognizes that the pandemic has affected segments of society differently. Blacks, Hispanics, women. Women have borne a greater burden with regard to this pandemic. The literature is replete with regard to that.
But I think right now we're only on non-COVID questions to explore the parameters of this critical stage argument that you're making. And if we're just talking about someone's going on a two-week cruise, and I'm saying that in deference to Justice Alvin, who's on a nautical bent today, but if they're going on a two-week cruise and it has nothing to do with COVID, presumably it's another time and place, you don't have the right to sit there with the jury manager as they answer that phone call and say yes, no on the cruise.
That's not the one. Justice, I don't have a problem with that one.
You don't have a problem,
I have a problem with that one.
So what you're saying is that you have a right, it becomes a critical stage because some of the interactions between the jury manager and the potential juror may involve concerns about or exposure to COVID. So COVID makes it a critical stage.
And beyond exposure to or is the effect of the disease on their ability to serve. I'll give an example. If it's the mom who has to stay home with the kids to make sure that they get, because they're being schooled remotely. Remember when we're talking about here? I think we have to be. We're talking about September of 2020.
Is it your argument that the jury manager has to say or should be saying, "I can't tell you the answer. You've got to come to court."
Yes, that happens all the time. And respectfully, that happens all the time.
Even though they may be showing symptoms of the COVID, you think they should come in the court?
I'm sorry, Justice.
Even though they may, when they talk to the manager saying, I'm suffering from the symptoms of COVID, I've tested positive. You think they should still come in the court to explain it?
It's not the health issue. If somebody says that they're sick, we don't want them in the building. I'm distinguishing.
Isn't that what those questions are designed to elicit, whether someone is sick or maybe sick?
I'm with the sick questions. The questionnaire deals with sickness, okay? But we recognize that there's something different about this selection process. There's something different, okay? We don't just ask we don't send out a questionnaire and say, did you have the flu today? Did you have a cold today? We specifically question with regard to this because of the importance of public health.
So is it only the questions with regard to a potential juror's concern about COVID that you are indicating is a critical, would be a critical stage that requires your participation?
In addition to concern with regard to, and it's not just, I'm afraid to go into the building because I don't want to be exposed. I think it's the issue of the effect. What is the effect that the pandemic has on the distinct population? And
so are you saying, if someone calls a jury manager and says, I think I may have been exposed,
I don't want them in the building. We don't want them in the building.
If someone calls and says, I am a part of a demographic that has been disproportionately impacted by COVID, I'm not sure I want to serve, you believe that that person has to come in and sit in court and be questioned by the juror, by the judge.
I believe, yes, that that person either has to come to court, comes to court. At a minimal, that information has to be cataloged. We have to know who's being excluded. This may be a
you
poor
You have to be participating in the decision as to whether that individual's jury service is deferred.
Yes, that goes beyond administrative, because I'm sorry, Chief.
No. I just want to try to further your argument along here, because we're well beyond the 20 minutes, and we haven't addressed your cross-section claim yet. So let me ask you to succinctly tell us, you've alleged that there's a violation, constitutional violation here. To make out such a claim, you have to show substantial underrepresentation over a significant period of time. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch as to how you have accomplished that?
Right. That issue, again, unique to this process and unique to this time in history, right? This isn't something systematic, as we dealt with the issue of systematic exclusion of minorities with regard to jury. Gilmore takes care of that. But what we're doing here is we're running this through a prism. Okay, my word is, what dramatic effect does this have? We don't have jurisprudence for this one, okay? This pandemic is on us, and we have to live it, and we have to execute through it.
The question you have been asked, what are your proofs? Just state them.
None.
For why there wasn't a cross.
They're none. The proofs are none. But I say this because we don't know. It's the tautology is that we don't know, because A, we don't know what discretion, if there was discretion, was exercised by jury management. Two, there's no record with regard to it. And three, the easiest way to be able to have solved this is to have those people.
One of the reasons why there's no record, maybe, is because the objection was made during the jury selection process, not when the objection should have been made, if there was a challenge to the veneer, correct?
I'm going to give you a little, with your permission, a little bit of an indirect and long-winded answer on that one. Everybody was aware. My sister, in her brief, Ms. Chasmer, puts in a brief that everybody was aware, as early as September and as early as the day before, the counsel. I wasn't trial counsel. Trial counsel was going to object to the process of the jury selection.
And the objection, the order to show cause, was leveled after the process had begun. Is that correct?
But 183 requires, it says in writing, I know the rule, okay? But 112 says that you can expand the rules for the efficiency of justice. Everybody was on notice that this was coming, or everybody was on notice. And so we know at 9:24, jury selection started on that morning. At 11:23, the notice of motion was, what the order to show cause was filed. 13, I got to get the numbers right, 13 people had already been talked about. But I would respectfully suggest it's Albin, but everybody was on notice that this was coming down the pike. I think prudence would have been, hold it off, because this would become the problem. And then they continued the jury process for the 4 days. So when they argued the...
I don't want to
okay.
expand this, but what you're saying is, the trial judge should be somewhat like of a mind reader. I think this motion may be coming, and maybe I should do something while I'm waiting for this motion to come. I don't even understand that. Counsel has an obligation. There are rules. You want to challenge the veneer. There's a time in which to do it. The time isn't to do it after, like, there are 13 people impaneled.
Justice, I understand, but again, I think the uniqueness of this situation may have invited caution.
I'm only saying this, Mr. Neary, because there may have been an opportunity to make a record. You have no record. You're coming here. I have no record. Can't tell you any proofs at all. Rely on speculation. That's what you're saying.
See, the retort always has been, this is all speculation, this is all speculation. If counsel were there, wouldn't be speculation. Wouldn't be. They would have seen. They would have counted. This was. They would have.
What deference do we give to the trial court's observation that the jury veneer seemed to represent a fair cross section of the population, and there was no comment by defense counsel to the court's observation?
I think that's a determination after the fact. I think you have to start from the cross section. You have to start with the cross. The analysis starts here, not at the end. Starts at the beginning,
And we can't give any deference to the fact that the court made that observation and counsel said nothing.
I think
nothing to put it in context as you're trying to do now.
Okay. I think it would be more critical. Again, not trial counsel, and may not have been cast in the best constitutional, you know, framework. But the trial counsel continuously said, I don't know who was picked. I don't know how they were picked. The morning of the order to show cause is when Brian McLaughlin and Ms. Figueroa's certifications were presented. The trial court relied on those, but never dug into what the three things that I asked about. How come we had, you know, well, do the...
In the interest of time, let's not go through them again.
Okay.
Are there other questions anyone has?
No.
Here, we have your position, and we'll have you back on rebuttal then.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. Mr. Krikora.
Chief, you threw me off a little bit with your comments at the right before we started, insofar as the as I had a basically like about a 3 to 5 minute little pitch to make to the court about an initiative, in essence, to collect data going forward. I do, however, with your indulgence,
and we're not discounting that. We have it, and we will consider it.
Yeah, no, and I would like to focus a little bit on this particular case to the extent that that's appropriate, which is, I think, what you wanted to do. I would view it in this sense. When the court started to try to figure out a way to resume jury trials with remote jury selection back last summer, the two concerns that came to our lawyers were, one, access to technology and the risk, or at least the potential, that some portion of the jury folks out there would be excluded because they either didn't have access to technology or the skill set to utilize it. That was one. And the second main concern, at least where there was a potential for skewing the jury panel, was the disproportionate impact that we already knew COVID-19 had on people of color, especially those living in urban communities, and that they would be disproportionately excluded from the process. So we had the questions that were devised to address the COVID-19 related issues. And one criticism I would have of the procedure that was used is that the jury manager did not keep separate track of the jurors who were excused based on those answers to the five COVID-19. They were put in one bucket of hardships, medical and otherwise. So as the jury manager exercised discretion to excuse or defer people because of their answers to those COVID-19 questions, we don't know, for example, whether or not this was someone who had a heart condition who would, under any circumstances, have been, you know, routinely excused because of medical reasons, or whether this was someone who was claiming to have a heart condition and therefore a greater concern of getting COVID-19, who might otherwise be able to serve but had this heightened concern because of the underlying condition. So I think what should have happened here is that the jury manager should have kept separate data with respect to those jurors that were excused because of their answers to those specific COVID-19 questions. Because I don't take issue with the process where routinely the jury manager has discretion to get people's pre-screening, to go back to Justice Albin's point, right? The pre-screening, the person writes in or calls in and says, I have prepaid tickets to go on vacation that week, and the jury manager routinely defers the person. Or the person says, I have surgery, or my father's in the hospital. And you know, there's basic ones. I would never suggest for a minute that the jury manager shouldn't exercise discretion in deferring or excusing those jurors.
Do you view that as a critical stage, Mr. Krikora?
Well, listen, I don't want to get into, you know, undermining the arguments of this defendant in this case, but I mean, I'm hard pressed to call that a critical stage if all the jury manager is doing is getting the questionnaire returned, right, by a juror. We had 533 of the 800 did return their questionnaires, as I understand the facts. And many of them probably put things on there. The questions ask for that information, right? And the jury manager exercises some basic level. Now, not all hardships are excused by the jury manager, because we know at the beginning of every trial in the courtroom, one of the first questions the judge says is, this trial is going to last 3 weeks. Would that pose a hardship for you? And people who are self-employed, for example, or people who have vacations in 3 weeks might have been able to sit on a one-week case. That happens. Those are folks who were obviously not excused by the jury manager as part of that pre-screening process. And I wouldn't take issue with any of that. I think that's appropriate. So I think if we're going to focus on the impact of the pandemic on jury selection, not just in this case that you're hearing the appeal, but let's face it, we're going to have some more remote jury selection going forward, because we're not done with this yet. We all want to get back to in-person proceedings, but we're going to continue to have COVID-19 related issues coming up with jurors who report for jury duty, whether that's remotely or even when they come back in person, right? People, for example, who are unvaccinated, who might have heightened fear of coming back into court. There's still issues that we're going to confront, and I think this case can be a vehicle for the court to maybe more clearly define how the jurors should be screened with respect to those concerns. And just one other point, Chief, if I'm getting off your direction, please forgive me, but I feel this is a really important point. In proposing to the court that we enhance our data collection of demographics going forward in this state, in terms of race, ethnic background, age, for example, two really dynamics at work. One, I think, is COVID-19, the impact on our criminal justice system, lessons to be learned, and lessons to be learned from this case. And I've kind of articulated those in terms of concerns about skewing the jury panel because of reasons specific to jury to COVID-19 that might potentially, we don't know, we don't have the data to support it, that's part of the issue. But the other one, I think, is lessons to be learned. And we didn't put this in our brief, and we probably should have. We talked about it. That's kind of lessons to be learned from CJR and analytics. We know from the success of CJR that analytics and enactment, implementation, the first 4 years, going forward, trying to perfect it, domestic violence, we all understand. We should recognize as a criminal justice system that there's a role for analytics, and there's a role for it in jury selection that has not historically been part of our practices.
Thank you.
And to the extent that, you know, making that pitch to the court, it's not meant to be an indictment of the procedures we've been using for the last four decades, going back to days when we had jury issues in the capital murder scenario, which only a couple of you have been around long enough to remember. And so I think those are points to be made, that this is just a vehicle perhaps for the court going forward, not just with the remote trials and the initial in-person trials where COVID-19 issues are still, but going forward beyond that to improve our system by recognizing what analytics could play in ensuring going forward that the court system is operating fairly, that people are not being unfairly excluded from jury duty. And it's just something that would improve the system simple step. Thank you, Chief.
Lesper.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm operating at somewhat of a disadvantage here today, not because of the nature of the legal issues, but because in applauding enthusiastically during the speeches, I actually broke my glasses, Exhibit A. I actually think these glasses may be the same glasses I wore 20-something years ago when I first argued before Justice LaVecchia, so their time had come in any event. I'd like to just briefly address the issue of critical stage, which is at the core of this argument today. Let's be clear. It's just kind of a tough case. We all know that on the one hand, there's the administrative phase of the process, the creation of the panel. On the other hand, there's what happens during voir dire. And everybody recognizes, this court has said, that what happens during voir dire is a critical stage. That is a critical stage. Counsel's supposed to be present. The defendant's supposed to be present. No doubt about that. On the other hand, what happens in the jury management office when I will tell you, I have done this. I have called the Morris County Jury Management Office and said, I have a vacation. I don't go on vacation that much, but I have done it. And I get my jury service deferred.
And that's been duly noted.
I'm sure you did note it.
Seven times a year seems like a lot.
Yeah, it does. You've got to have a conversation with my wife about that. So the question is, where is that line drawn? And it's a hard line to draw because the questions, and this is uniquely so, the questions that are raised at each of those two stages are identical in some ways. Mr. Neary correctly states that when you get in front of the judge, a lot of the questions about hardship, about mental and physical condition, about financial issues, and in fact, I would invite the court to look at the administrative office's own model questions for voir dire in the criminal cases. It encompasses those things. So what's hard about this issue for the court is that the same questions that are being raised at the in the creation of the veneer are also asked in open court. And in one case, we say nobody has to be there, and in another case, we say the defendant has an absolute right. So here's my, on behalf of the Bar Association, proposed solution to that conundrum, because I think it's a conundrum. First, I think that if there's any question as to whether somebody qualifies to be on the jury under 2B20-1, which includes mental and physical capacity, or if there's any question as to their qualifications for an excuse under 2B20-10, if it's a close question, the judge should decide in the presence of counsel and the defendant. To put it another way, the way I would put it is that there should be a presumption in that can be overcome by doctor's notes, by evidence, whatever, that the jury management office can deploy as to whether and when a person does not have to go before the jury. There can be a presumption that they don't.
I want to understand.
Yeah, I said that poorly, so no wonder you're asking a question.
We have the selection of veneer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Large group of people,
right,
who may be going off to a number of different juries. So illness is presented to the jury manager.
Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting that all the potential attorneys involved in the case gather together?
Absolutely.
No?
Not.
Okay.
There, if Mr. McLaughlin, my friend Mr. McLaughlin, who lays this out in his certification, people come show up with a doctor's note, and generally, what either the assignment judge or the jury management office will do, who's designated by the assignment judge, will say, "You have a doctor's note. Fine, you're excused." I'm not contending, I'll come to a second stage of this, but I'm not contending that in any way that counsel should be present for that or that the defendant should be present. That is not a critical stage. That can be accepted. But, you know, not every doctor's note is the same. Not every excuse is the same. And when there's doubt, Your Honor, what I would say is that in that case, the matter should go before the court. And
Mr. Lusberg, are you advancing that suggestion as a policy suggestion or as something that's constitutionally required? Does the close question create a critical stage, or are you just offering this as thoughtful advice for how things should proceed?
Well, I'm happy if anybody solicits my thoughtful advice, but no, I believe because we all know that that these questions come up, Chief, in the context of voir dire, which is a critical phase, there should not be an end run around that process. That is, as a matter of constitutional law, we can't take things that ought to have been presented to the court.
It's not an end run. You know, it may very well be when the general veneer is being selected, someone doesn't mention their vacation. Now they're in the box, okay? And they're asked the question, are you gonna have problems serving on this jury? Well, I'm going to Disney World in a week. That's not an end run. That's just it comes up at a different point.
That you're right. That's not an end run. But there can be, and I don't mean to use the term end run in a disparaging fashion. But there will be times when somebody will say, we'll make a presentation as to a medical condition or even a vacation plan that jury managers are just going to accept because it's the easy way to do it,
logistically and timing, in terms of timing, how could this possibly be? Because that call, that communication from the prospective juror who's gotten a notice weeks in advance of the service may happen on June 29th, mm-hmm. and the actual trial dates may actually be for much later, just a month from now or whatever. And to make the decision, the jury manager would then have to try to figure out who's actually going to trial of all of the lawyers who are potentially on the calendar in all of the cases, and then make an event in those cases, make it into an event in those cases.
I'm not making myself clear. It's just I'm frustrated by my own inability to make this clear because I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that there are somebody comes before the jury manager and says, I have an illness. I'm physically incapable. I have a problem in my family, whatever it is. That excuse may be very valid, or it may be questionable.
Mr. Lusberg, if I may. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Justice.
You indicated a few seconds ago that it's the managers take the easy way out by excusing people. Do you have any information out? Because I sat as assignment judge in Camden for a while, and my jury managers did not let anybody out because it was easy.
Okay.
So I don't know if you have any actual proof of that.
I don't, but here's what I really, and this is really the second point I was going to get to, and what I think in some ways is the most critical part of this. What we now know is that the role that the jury manager plays is one that affects the voir dire that comes later. And that voir dire is a critical stage. And so what has to happen, what did not happen here, and what prevents me from having the very information that you're asking me about, is that these excuses are not readily documented. And under 2B20-9, they're supposed to be. The way jury managers decide on requests for excusals and requests for deferrals, this court should be clear, should be documented so that they can be part of any meaningful judicial review, so that a defendant can really make the argument as whether they were denied the right to be present when they should have been able to be present. And by the way,
Do that if the person's been excused? How do you trace that deferred or excused person back to the trial of the defendant who wants to later raise that argument?
You don't.
And it sounds to me what your argument really is that you want to have us interpret 2B20-9's legislative authorization to the AJ to designate someone to assist in this review process in a more limited fashion than we have, in order to require more decisions not to be decided by the designee, but to be required to go to the AJ. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in instances of doubt, where there's any question, there should be a presumption that the matter goes before a judge for the appropriate case.
So you are limiting what would be considered an administrative processing more narrowly to require more things being pushed to the courtroom voir dire setting, and therefore clearly being the critical stage.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
What is the appropriate case? I'm sorry to be repetitive about this, but what is the appropriate case for an excuse that is requested today when August is not a good example, but when in September there may be hundreds of trials or there may be no trials?
I understand. So I get a jury notice today. I get a doctor's note that says I have diabetes, which I do. And now that should not be a basis to excuse me, but the jury manager can decide right then and there, regardless of what case it is, whether I'm excused or not. What I'm saying is in those cases where there's not an appropriate showing, what the jury manager should do is say, you know what, you're going to have to show up, go before the judge and make your excuse. At that point, there'll be a real trial on a real date with a real defendant, and that matter can be decided. It's not hypothetical.
That would take the assignment judge out of the loop also then, because you want a hearing on it. Do you expect a hearing in front of the assignment judge?
Absolutely not. This is not a matter of having any kind of hearing. It's a matter of gathering data. Look, what this court does for a living is it reviews decisions of lower courts and agencies that determine whether those decisions are proper.
So when would you object at that point? Because if the assignment judge, there's no hearing, the assignment judge decides a valid excuse, after the trial, you get the review and then object to the
the defendant could object to the construction of the veneer and ask for data.
They won't beat her on the veneer if the assignment judge excused them before before your trial.
What I'm suggesting is that data be made available at that point. Not only demographic data, which others have addressed, but the reasons for the decision by the jury manager.
The statute provides 2B20-9B, records shall be kept of all requests for excuses and deferrals and of the granting of excuses and deferrals, correct?
Correct. And I don't know whether that's typically done. What I do know is that from the record of this case that it was not done here, and it leads me to at least suspect that that does not happen regularly and that those records are not being made available to defendants in subsequent criminal cases. And what I'm suggesting is that that's what should occur.
I thought you were done. I'm afraid we need to cut short the
interview
with other advocates lined up behind you. Thank you very much.
I just want to say one quick thing, if I might. I did mention, and I promise
you can condense it to 1 minute.
It has nothing to do with this case. I have to say something about Justice Lavecchia as well. You know, all the justices spoke, and it was wonderful to listen to. from the perspective of an advocate, especially one who's appeared before her so many times, I just wanted to express our congratulations to her on a spectacular career and on that next phase. She has distinguished this court with her down-to-earth brilliance, her rigorous attention to justice, but tempered by humanity, and by the fact that she's incredibly hardworking, but also has a great sense of humor. It has been my honor as to have appeared before her this many times. I'm so happy to be here on this last day, and I just felt, Your Honor, that I would be remiss if I didn't say that before I sat down today. So thank you.
I know that others may want to do exactly that, so I am going to assume for the record that you all agree with what was just said about the justice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kingman.
May it please the court. I, like the public defender, am somewhat at a disadvantage because I had planned to only argue about the fundamental structural error that occurred below.
You are welcome, and I mean this seriously, to rest on your papers. We have them. We have reviewed them. Please do not feel that you need to fill up 5 or 10 minutes with an argument that you had not presented in your brief. You will not at all be chastised for that in any way.
Thank you, Chief. If I could just make one point that is not in my papers because it could not have been known at that time, and it should take less than a minute, and then I will rest.
Go ahead.
So I just want to discuss the evolution of the participation of the Attorney General and the Administrative Office of the Courts in this matter.
We're not touching that issue. I'm sorry.
It would take less than 30 seconds.
We are not discussing that issue in oral argument as laid out at the outset. We have your submission on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
Ms. Chasmer.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I do have a prepared preliminary statement. However, I would like to just start with a reaction to defense counsel's presentation this morning. This court has stated throughout the pandemic that a generalized fear of contracting the COVID-19 virus is insufficient to gain relief. And I would argue that in this sense, it's also insufficient to gain the relief of getting out of jury duty. The COVID-19 questionnaire was not gauged at assessing potential jurors' reactions to serving on a jury during the pandemic. It was really gauged to assess who had been exposed in that jury pool to COVID and eventually who would be excused because of that exposure. And the state would submit that that would be a documented medical inability to serve, which jury managers are certainly able to excuse those jurors under their statutory authority. This court has also acknowledged that as life amid the COVID-19 pandemic goes on, the criminal justice system cannot stand still. This case illustrates our ability to actually move forward during the pandemic, using modern technology to guarantee defendants' constitutional rights while ensuring the safety of all participants, including the over 100 Bergen County residents who are ordered to appear for jury duty in this case. It's important to remember that at the time of defendant's trial, our state was experiencing an uptick in cases of the highly transmissible and all too often deadly COVID-19 virus. And we know that because our court's jury trials were suspended again mere weeks after defendant's conviction in this case. But despite the conditions outside of the courthouse in September and October 2020, defendant was able to successfully secure a jury by which he was tried in person and convicted. The hybrid jury selection procedure proved to be an efficient and effective way to pick a jury amid a pandemic. Via Zoom, the trial court conducted probing and comprehensive voir dire of 178 potential jurors over a period of 3.5 days. 63 individuals were required to report in person after the virtual phase. That meant 115 individuals, potential jurors, were excused without ever having to walk into the courthouse. As community members, we've all been called upon to stay home and social distance to slow the spread of the virus. By conducting the initial phase on Zoom, we avoided the usual gathering of dozens, if not hundreds, of potential jurors in a single courtroom for that first initial phase of voir dire. The state submits that the defendant has established no grounds here today for relief based on the use of the hybrid virtual procedure. His arguments are being made for the first time before this court and can be dismissed on that ground alone. Additionally, the defense's arguments are really aimed at the ordinary jury selection procedures. None of those procedures were altered in a substantive way by this court's July 22nd order. And the defense doesn't challenge any of the new procedures, aside from the questionnaire that was ordered in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So the state maintains that the defense really hasn't presented that very narrow issue that this court agreed to review. As for the substance of defendant's claim, he has the burden to establish a fatal flaw in the new procedure. And because his claims are untimely, he must do so by showing actual prejudice. The defense was unable to show actual prejudice before the trial court. As trial counsel conceded, the jury selection process in this case, although it occurred virtually, was absolutely fair. And here, the defense has also failed to make that showing. He has offered only speculation and supposition to support his claims. With respect to the cross-section claim, and I know we really didn't get into it in too much detail today, I will just say that it's a product of guesswork about the effect of the pandemic on the rate of the juror turnout of Blacks, Hispanics, and females. The statistics that the defense offers this court are not tied to Bergen County, and they're certainly not tied to the jury veneer that showed up for defendant's case. Additionally, the statistics do nothing to undermine the presumption that the veneer was drawn in a constitutionally permissible way. The record establishes that Bergen County's jury manager followed our state's ordinary procedures in producing that array. That procedure includes the random selection of jurors from a neutral source list. There really is no opportunity for discrimination of the individual discrimination of one jury manager using that neutral procedure. And although we're not addressing it today, the state submits that because of that neutral procedure, the sudden call to collect demographic data is unwarranted. Additionally, demographic data is not needed in this case, as I've already stated, to evaluate whether the procedure was constitutional. As the trial court found, the jury array was representative, and he noted that any objection based on the racial demographics of the panel that showed up to court virtually would have been meritless. Of course, trial counsel made no such objection. Additionally, the state submits that the point in which jury management excuses and defers jurors according to statutory authority, that is not a critical stage. It is an administrative process that occurs before any potential juror is required to show up to court and before any specific juror is assigned to a panel, meaning criminal or civil, or a specific defendant's case. So a defendant or their attorney's presence at this stage would be of little use. Whether an individual meets the criteria, the statutory criteria to be excused or deferred, does not need to be litigated. And again, assignment judges and their designees are statutorily authorized to make these ministerial decisions on their own. Additionally, during a pandemic, conducting excusals and deferrals in court with the parties present would be logistically burdensome. Of course, our interaction with the public is still limited and will likely be so for a long time during this pandemic. And while our state has yet to confront the issue of whether this is a critical stage, other jurisdictions have had little problem rejecting that claim. As noted in our brief, as well as the Attorney General's and the County Prosecutors Association, a number of federal courts and other states have had little trouble finding that the right to be present and the right to be represented at that stage does not exist. In sum, the defense has not established a fault in the new procedure, and to the contrary, This case actually proves that the process is valuable in moving the criminal justice system forward as this pandemic continues to linger. That concludes my prepared statement, and I welcome any questions from the court.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Leonard.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The defendant has failed to establish a prima facie case challenging the jury selection process here. That is his burden. And all indications are that there were no defects in the process, as has been noted today. The trial judge noted that there wouldn't have been a basis for any objection and stated that the hybrid process implemented by this court was likely going to be a success. And the prosecutor noted that they could see jurors of all backgrounds, both genders, all socioeconomic backgrounds, all ages. So in the idea that there was not a cross-section of the community represented in this case is not based in reality. And we can also know that the jury yield was roughly the same in this case as it would have been in other cases. This case is unique because it was a pilot case, so it happened to be the only trial for which a jury was being selected at that time. But as Your Honors have noted, the practical difficulties with involving any party in these ministerial questions, it wouldn't be feasible pre-pandemic or even as we see this process continue in the foreseeable future with the virtual selection. Presumably, there will be several virtual juries selected at a time. And a party doesn't have a right to say whether somebody can stay home because they have a child with disabilities or a vacation, and certainly not if somebody has any concerns about COVID-19, concerns like specific concerns, not the generalized. But that's not something that I would suspect that most judges would weigh on err on the side of caution with that, take people at their word if they say they have symptoms. And so that's not something a party could really weigh in on there. And just because the question is asked again during the jury, during voir dire about reasons somebody may not be able to sit for a particular amount of time, doesn't mean that that question being asked on the questionnaire is somehow a constitutional trigger. It's asked again as a practical matter, but that doesn't make it a critical stage. I just note that these COVID-19 questionnaires are completely commonplace to go into businesses, schools, doctor's appointments. We see them all the time now. And it's just a matter of precaution, which is hopefully temporary. And finally, if Your Honors do have any concerns about the alleged conflict with our office, I'm happy to address them. But otherwise, I will rest on my brief unless Your Honors have any questions.
Questions? No. Thank you, Ms. Leonard.
Thank you.
Ms. Shashua.
May it please the court, I have one point at this stage, reading the tenor of the court, that the CPA and Jay just ask this court to decline the invitation to make this a critical stage. This is supported by the ABA, this process of having the jury management address non-substantive hardship excusals and deferrals. The only concern constitutionally is whether it would touch on the substance of the case, and nothing. This was certified by the jury management staff. Nothing that goes on in those proceedings touches on the defendant's ability to defend present a defense in his case. In terms of what has been changed since the pandemic in these procedures, there's nothing substantive that was changed from pre-pandemic to post-pandemic, other than the disabling of the self-deferral option, which my last point is, if anyone's needed to seek an extension before Judge Misano, you understand, you would just get the brief in. self-deferrals by, I think, the post-pandemic has probably lessened the volume of people seeking deferrals because they had to go before somebody in person as opposed to doing it themselves. So if anything, as the AOC recognized in this case, this was a matter of probably lessening the deferrals that occurred here. We'd ask this court, other than that, to rest on our brief, unless there are any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Neary, you asked for 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Please, Chief, I have but 2 points to make.
Point number one, if you take a look at 2B20-9, subsection B specifically says the assignment judge may require verification of any facts supporting the grounds for a request of or for excuse or deferral. Records shall be kept of all requests for excuses and denials and for the granting of the excuses and denials. Secondly, my task and my focus is singular. I represent one man. I represent Mr. Danksel. We've used the term pilot case. We've used the term test case. That's often discussed in the PowerPoint. What I am suggesting is that there was no ability to see what these 326 people, why they were excused from service by the jury management. We were denied participation at the critical stage to be able to do that. No lawyer, no defendant being present. I suggested that, and it's discussed in the PowerPoint, the term straightforward trial. Very honestly, Justices, I've never tried a straightforward trial.
Ms. Neary, may I ask you one question? Did you ask for the documents that are supposed to be preserved in the B section of the statute?
No. Trial counsel did not ask for that. I would suggest, Judge, maybe it's a responsibility to produce it. I don't know if anybody's ever read that statute that closely, honestly.
I assure you, I have many times as an assignment.
I'm wondering why you mentioned the statute if there was no request for the records.
The question is, who is it incumbent upon to preserve the records and produce them?
Well, I would assume that if there isn't a request, there isn't a problem. You told me that the defense counsel did not request
it. I don't think anybody in the flurry of that morning ever thought about that. I don't think anybody even looked at the statute. Honestly, Justice, I don't think anybody looked at the statute.
And whose fault is that?
I'll give you one person whose fault it isn't. It's not Mr. Danksel's. It's not Mr. Danksel's. And that's the focus. I opened up with my arguments with regard to numbers. There's one number that in this straightforward trial, in this first trial, 18 years. This man got an 18-year sentence as a result of this case. Chief, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all counsel. Very helpful briefs. Thank you for the argument. I'm going to add a word for Ms. Kingman. Unfortunately, your argument was eclipsed by the limited nature of the grant and the arguments that the defendant proposed. Rest assured, we welcome you back, and we look forward to hearing you argue in another case. Court's in recess till 1 o'clock.